This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Marty Richardson was in high school when he started a deep dive into the culture and history of his community, the Halawasaponi Indian tribe. He emerged from dusty library archives with a painful realization. His ancestral language, Tutelo-Saponi, was nearly dead. In those archives, Marty found Tutelo word lists and information about related languages. The sparse documents helped Marty on his mission to bring back a language that's been considered dormant since the 1700s. Today, we're going to explore how languages disappear and why people are trying to save them. Marty Richardson is the director of the Halawasaponi Historic Legacy Project, and he is considered to be one of only a handful of nearly fluent Tutelo speakers in the world. Marty, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Take us back to high school and your interest in learning more about the Halawasaponi.
Well, it all started, I guess, a two-pronged approach. The first had to do with already being involved, heavily involved in my culture as a dancer and then as a singer. And our drum groups, we were singing the songs of other tribes, and we were singing in different languages. And so we really didn't have a way to express ourselves. And one of our tribal elders, Arnold Richardson, he had done some work with Saponi. He had found some word lists that were recorded back in the 1700s, the 1713, 1714. And so he really got me interested just to know that there was some of our language that was there. But the other process that I went through was that I was living in Baltimore, Maryland at the time. We had moved up to Baltimore for my parents to find jobs and things like that. And so a lot of times people would ask me who I am, what I am. And so when you come into processes like that and folks kind of questioning who you are, you really take a look at yourself and say, well, what do I know about myself? And that's kind of what happened when I was in middle school and then in high school. And so that kind of set me off on a journey to find out more about my people, about my Halawasaponi people. And through that process, by knowing that some of the Saponi language had been written down, I started looking at Saponi, and I noticed that the Tutelo tribe was one of the allied tribes and also spoke the same language as the Saponis. And then from there, I found out that there was a lot more of the language that had been recorded. And so as a 14, 15-year-old, I started doing research. I go to local libraries, I go to local universities, and I found the published articles on Tutelo, and that's kind of what set me off as far as learning about the language. And then from those articles, I also learned that they were unpublished materials at the National Anthropological Archives. And so as a 15, 16-year-old, I had my parents drop me off in Washington, D.C., and
You made them drive you from Baltimore to D.C. so you could do your research.
They did.
Well, at least you were doing your homework. Well, what did they say about all this? I mean, your interest in this, is that something that they were proud of? Or?
Well, they were happy that I was doing some native stuff and not listening to so much hip-hop. So they were happy about that.
Tell us a little bit more about the Saponi. What's the range? Where would we find the Saponi?
The Saponi probably originated a lot of the it's a Siouan tribe. Saponi and Tutelo are Siouan tribes, and a lot of them originated in the Ohio Valley. And so you had a couple different groups of Siouan speakers. Some of them moved out west to become the Lakota and other tribes out west, and then others moved to the south. And so you had southeastern tribes like the Biloxi, the Ofo tribes, and also Saponis and others, Tutelos, that moved down into Virginia. And so the Tutelos and Saponis ranged into Piedmont, Virginia, kind of middle Virginia, and into North Carolina. And then when we had contact, they started moving around even more because they had trading partners and, of course, wars and things like that.
Talk about it. I mean, this also points to one of the problems in trying to identify a language, particularly one that's been more or less dormant for several hundred years. And that is that these languages change anyway. Living languages change. And particularly as groups move to different locations, then we see some dramatic changes. So even defining what is the Tutelo language, it seems to me, must be a first challenge, right?
Well, a lot of it has to do with written versus unwritten. And the Tootaloos and Saponis, you had basically two main bands of them. And so by 1722, a lot of the Tootaloos and Saponis and other tribes started making peace with the Iroquois and others and started moving up north. And of course, you have the Tuscaroras as well, who became the sixth nation of out of the five nations. And so they migrated from North Carolina. And so there was a big migration, but you also had bands of tribes that stayed in the south. But the in the north, you had more of a cultural renaissance or sharing cultures and keeping cultures alive in the north among the Iroquois people is where the Tootaloos went and lived. They were adopted by the Iroquois. And so that's where the language survived much longer, yeah. Or at least from long enough for it to be written down. And that's how we have some materials of the Tootalo language.
What about speakers, fluent speakers? What did you learn about when we might guess the last fluent speaker left us?
Well, the southern bands is kind of hard to say. Amongst all of our tribes here in North Carolina, you have those elders who remember when they were young, the elders would go in a back room somewhere and talk in a language that you didn't really know about, that you didn't know anything about it. But then, of course, up north, as I stated earlier, you had a lot of the language to survive much longer up north. And so we have stories about Tootaloos up north that still spoke the language as early as recent as the 1980s.
What do you do when you try to reconstruct a whole language, again, mostly from word lists and a little bit of spoken language? How do you put it together, and how much have you been able to reconstruct?
Well, you have to take what you already have, and I'd say probably for Tootalo, what has survived and what is still written down, you probably have maybe 600 words. And so you take the grammar, the person that published or finished her dissertation on Tootalo, her name was Julia Oliverio, and she was at University of Kansas, which was a hotbed and still a hotbed for Siouan linguistics. She analyzed a lot of the available Tootalo data. And so we take that data and we use the grammar and other things and reconstruct words that way. But then, as you stated, language is always changing things. And one of the things about languages is that we have to have new words. We have to have a word for microphone, for computer, for car, all these things. And so that's something that all languages have to do. We do that with English. We have to make new words. And so that's kind of the process. But beyond that, a lot of tribes have been successful with comparing their language, if there isn't a lot of material to work with, comparing their language to what we call proto-linguistics. Mm-hmm. So we have proto-Siouan, proto-Algonquin, for example, and those are the basis. And you use that information to create new words and to try to figure out what that word would have been.
Well, the vocabulary, but also the structure, it seems to me, there you might even find more overlap, more commonality in structures among Siouan languages. But if you talk about proto-languages, how is that preserved if there wasn't writing, or was there?
From what I understand, the process of developing a proto-language is comparing mm-hmm. the different languages within that language group. And so, for instance, with Siouan linguistics, you'll take your southeastern Siouan, you'll take your Lakotas, you'll take all those different languages and compare the words mm-hmm. from those languages. And from that, you can, it's pretty much a scientific guess of what the original words would be. And so that's kind of the basis of the language.
You're a member of the Stony Creek Singers, and you often perform at powwows, as you said, in cultural events. Then you realized, I think, at a certain point that you were not singing in your own language. Have you been able to develop songs in your language now?
Oh, for sure. We started Stony Creek in 1993, and we've probably composed, I'd say, maybe 500 songs or more in the language. And then from that, we have other drum groups too that have adopted that, or they're from our tribe or even from other tribes that have used that language in their songs. And so I would say that there are probably 800 songs out here that are in the language.
We have a little sample of one of those right now.
Thank you.
Stony Creek singers performing in Tutelo, an ancestral language of the Halawasapone tribe. My guest is Marty Richardson, who's the director of the Halawasapone Historic Legacy Project, leading a Tutelo language revitalization project for his community. You know, it seemed to me, too, that, music is one of the places where it survives. Were you surprised that not as many songs survived in the Tutelo language?
Well, the type of songs that, we perform is more of an intertribal powwow style. And we do have some ceremonial songs that survived in Tutelo. And those were actually recorded as well, you know, not only written down, but actually audio recorded. And so a lot of the ceremonial songs and things like that still survive in, the Iroquois land today. They and also there's a revitalization of those types of, dance and song here in North Carolina as well. The Escanye is one of the traditional Tutelo-style dances that was performed and still performed up north, but it's also made a resurgence back here in the South and in North Carolina as well. So that's kind of how we revitalize not only our language, but also other aspects of our culture, and it's a kind of a springboard there.
This story is replicated around the world. Native and minority languages die out for a lot of reasons. The effects of colonization is primary among them. Today, we're exploring endangered and extinguished languages and the efforts to keep them alive. Ana Luisa Daño is program director at Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, and she is based in Greensboro and joins us now. Ana, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Talk more about North Carolina. We're talking about Halawasapone and the Tutelo language. Give us a picture of some of the languages and language groups spoken in North Carolina.
Well, at the time of European contact, there were roughly about 25 or so indigenous languages. Hard to know exactly because many of them have gone extinct. And they belong to three different large language families, Algonquian, Iroquois, and Iroquoian and Siouan. Yeah. The language that Marty has been reviving as part of the Siouan language family. And so there were even possibly some language isolates who, you know, they disappeared and we don't have enough data to know what language family they belong to. And many of these languages disappeared in North Carolina as a result of the speakers dying of infectious diseases and warfare.
What do we know? And so how many of them can we tell if they've evolved or changed or gone extinct? Is there any way to really measure and know that with a degree of certainty?
Well, for North Carolina languages, the history is quite complex because many people were forced to flee westward or northward. And so some of those groups of people joined other tribes. And so their descendants still have some remnants of the language. Mm-hmm. So there, it's a fragmented history, really. It's hard to have a clear picture of what happened. Each language saw a slightly different fate.
And what do you do when you identify these languages? Again, the effort is to try to keep them alive. Give us a, a sense of the various states that you find them in, and then what you do to, keep them going.
So many language, up to half of the languages in the world right now are considered vulnerable in some way. So they range from vulnerable to stable. So a language is considered under threat when there are either few speakers left or there are still a number of speakers, but many of them are over 50 or 60 or 65, and they're not being replaced by a young community or a young generation of speakers. So there's examples of languages throughout the world that, may disappear by the end of this century if there aren't efforts underway now to revitalize them.
And what do those efforts look like?
So they range depending on the community needs. In some places, there's already bilingual educational materials. There's recordings online and video. So in some places, there's already significant efforts and significant materials that exist that people can use. For example, the Oneida Nation, which can be found in upstate New York and in Ontario, and also in the Midwest, there are some pockets. They have a substantial amount of language materials out there. So revitalization becomes easier when you actually have materials to work from. In other places where Living Tongues, we've worked, Living Tongues Institute, we've worked all over the world. And some of our main projects have been India, Papua New Guinea, Micronesia, and other places in the Pacific. And sometimes we work with communities who have no writing system and no records whatsoever of the language. So we're really starting from scratch.
Yeah, and I would think the effects of globalization are really accelerating the loss of languages around the world. It would be just be a guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The dominance of English on the internet and in the media is certainly impacting languages everywhere, and the other dominant languages as well, Spanish, French, Arabic, Russian, Chinese, so many languages that have prominence. But I would also argue that because of globalization, we have all these digital tools at our disposal now that can help us revitalize.
Tell us about, there was a language that existed in North America that disappeared just this January when the last speaker, the last known speaker died. Tell us about Dora Manchado.
Dora Manchado was the last speaker of Tehuelche, which was a language spoken in Patagonia in Argentina. This language was actually thought to be extinct for a long time, but the local community knew that they had a speaker left. And my colleague from University of Montreal, Javier Domingo, he was doing anthropological studies in this part of Patagonia, and he met Dora Manchado. And so he worked with her for the last few years of her life, and he was able to make some excellent recordings of her speaking that are very useful for the community now.
We have a little sample of that right here. That is a translation of Dora Manchado, who we think is the last known speaker of Tehuelche. Do we know what she was saying?
Yes, those were four phrases back to back. The first was, take a picture of me, followed by, I'm full, followed by, I don't have any money, and the last one was, that was quite a stumble.
You know, it's one thing to try to maintain vocabulary. What do we do about structure and try to reconstruct a language that way?
Well, it takes a lot of work. It takes years of dedication to study the grammar, the morphology, syntax. All of that requires the collaboration between linguists and community members to really dig in and understand the structure of a language.
And, of course, interested people like you. Marty Richardson, let me ask you about efforts. You're working very hard. Do you have like-minded souls? Is it easy to find students so that you can transmit and keep the language going?
Well, we actually have... We have classes once a week in our community, and it's kind of whittled down. A lot of times when it's a lot of big commitment to learning language. And so a lot of times when we start our classes, we'll start off with, say, 20 people, and then we'll whittle down to maybe eight or so. And right now we have about eight students that are really involved. They're really committed to being there and learning the grammar. And, of course, I would be remiss not to mention a young gentleman in our community. His name is Matthew Richardson. He's taking a big interest in the language. I'd say in 2010, we had an apprenticeship. And so that was really focused on trying to get young people involved. And he's one of the people that emerged out of that apprenticeship to be really interested in the language.
That's Marty Richardson, who's the director of the Halawasapony Historic Legacy Project. And now I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Gilliam Jackson is a longtime Cherokee language teacher and an adjunct instructor of Cherokee at UNC Asheville, one of about 200 fluent Cherokee speakers in the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. Gilliam, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tell us about, you were raised speaking Cherokee as your mother tongue. How fluent were you, and how much Cherokee was being spoken around you as you grew up?
My parents were fluent Cherokee speakers, and actually my mom did not speak too much English, and she was able to count money, and she could communicate to some extent. My grandmother didn't speak at all. She may have known a couple of words. My grandfather was fluent in English as well as in Cherokee, and my dad was fluent in Cherokee. So me and all my siblings, Cherokee was our first language, and we didn't begin to learn to speak English until about 5 or 6 years old when we entered day school.
Well, what was that like for you? What was your sense of the Cherokee language and English language? Did you want to? Because, you know, I think we're going to hear that it's not easy and that young folks growing up aren't always interested in learning their mother tongue. How did you feel about it?
It was a blessing. I've always considered the fact that our parents spoke to us in the language, and they went through some hard times. I mean, they had to go to boarding school where the government said you can't use your language. You could be punished if you speak your language, and even at that, they felt it was important for us to be able to speak our language. And I'm truly blessed to have learned, and I think our whole family's blessed. Most of our family's been involved in teaching or passing the language on to our young kids, to kids in school, to kids in the community, and as well as adults. So I've taught all my life. And
you also attended a unique school where you were allowed to keep speaking the language. Tell us about that experience and how it compares with what was happening in other schools.
Well, given the time that I was in school around the 1950s, the government had a policy of assimilation, and they actually wanted to do away with the Native American. And one way of doing that was to put them in schools and forbid us any kind of cultural practices, any kind of religion, any kind of language, anything to do with our culture and heritage. But it seemed like in this particular community that I grew up, we had two incredible teachers, Albert and Louise Lee, who've since passed on. But I remember going to school the very first day, and I had absolutely no vocabulary in English. And I don't even remember... I don't even think I knew how to say I need to go use the restroom. And what I had to do was I had to go and ask maybe a third grader, who was probably my brother, and ask him, you know, hey, I got to go pee. What am I supposed to say? And he mumbled something that didn't make any sense to me. So I went over to the teacher and I mumbled something. I probably said something like, may I be excused, but really broken. And the teacher pointed to the bathroom, so I went. Mm. So our teachers, even though the government, they were government employees, they didn't follow and adhere to the government policy of assimilation. They actually encouraged us to use the language. And I think because they allowed us to use the language, I could go and ask somebody else, well, how do you say this? Mm-hmm. And use my language. So they were just very kind, but they encouraged us also to learn English because they said, you're going to need to learn English because that's what you're going to be working in.
Well, Ana Luisa Deño, at the program director at Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. What about around the world these days? Is there resistance to people learning or maintaining their tongues the way there was certainly here in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. What Mr. Jackson just described, policies that make it difficult for children to use their own mother tongues in schools. Those policies exist in countries around the world. Each country is a little different right now with how they embrace and promote indigenous languages. So for example, in New Zealand, you see a really strong cultural push backed up by great policies to promote the Maori language. And so that language is flourishing and people love it. And, you know, it has done a lot to protect the language and culture of the Maori.
Why is it important to maintain a language like that if it's not going to be a dominant language, if it's not going to be used in global commerce? Why is it important to maintain it?
It's important for the cultural identity of the people themselves, the people of the community who spoke the language ancestrally, to maintain that heritage and create that sense of self and the connection to the past. And affirming the past creates a better sense of well-being in the present. There's a lot of benefits associated with maintaining one's language and with that music, as Marty Richardson was saying, and other cultural aspects that are very important to preserve.
Gilliam Jackson, how is that going for you? You said you're teaching and you've been teaching for a long time. You've considered it a blessing to maintain your language. But is it an easy sell in your community, particularly among young people, to learn the Cherokee language?
I would say in the last 20 years, there has been kind of like a revitalization, people kind of waking up and said, hey, you know, we're going to lose our language, and I better get busy. And so I've had pretty good success in young people coming back and said, you know, can you teach us? I had a young man call me last, about this time last year, and he was in high school, and he emailed me. He said, I want to come live with you. And he's 17 years old, and I'm 67 years old. And I just kind of wondered, why would you want to come live with a 67-year-old man? I mean, you know, you. But anyway, he answered back, and he said, I want you to speak English or Cherokee only to me while I'm living with you, if you will allow me to live with you. And so, yes, there's been a revitalization. And he did come live with me for the summer, and he was incredible. He's not the only one. There are other people like that.
Well, I know that you were involved in creating an immersion school for Cherokee in Western North Carolina. Tell me how that went and what kinds of results you were seeing.
We started with infants, and we started speaking to them exclusively in the language. And it was wonderful and very successful. The kids, as they grew older and older and they began to pick up the language, they would play in the playground and they would argue in the playground. They would be mad at each other in the playground. But also the laughter was unique in that the laughter was similar to the laughter of fluent speakers. Even when they took naps, you know, kids talk sometimes. They would be speaking in Cherokee. So it was very successful, and I'm no longer with the program. And I've been gone for about 5 years, I believe. And I think things have changed in that program now. But it was very successful.
Marty Richardson.
Another example.
Oh, go ahead.
We almost had a rule. The kids made the rule themselves that if they heard English being used in the classroom, they set up a chair, and they would have to punish themselves, and they would sit in the chair for 5 minutes. Of course, they didn't really have a concept of time. 5 minutes could have been a minute. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to be in the lunchroom one time, and I goofed up and said an English word. And two little girls came up to me, and they talking to me. They said, "You have to sit in the brown chair." And this is all in the language. So yeah. I sat in the brown chair for probably 30 seconds. Of course, mm-hmm. they said 5 minutes, mm-hmm. but not having a concept of time, I got back up and I apologized to him and said it wouldn't happen again.
There's where the cultural distinction worked to your advantage. Well, that's good. But talk about this, Marty, the idea that there is an interest among all peoples of the world to save their languages, and yet each one is unique. I mean, is there an effort to sort of come together to create any kind of a movement that would create a bigger scene, right, and bigger pressure, more pressure, and yet still allow each group to pursue their own language?
Well, there are organized efforts for language revitalization. I can mostly only speak to in native country, in Indian Territory, about revitalizing languages. I know maybe a couple months ago there was a Senate hearing on language revitalization where some folks went and testified about language revitalization and why it's so important for Congress to support those efforts. I know, and then there are other organizations throughout North America that focus on coming together to learn from each other and learn about the pitfalls and the issues surrounding language revitalization. So there is a big effort throughout, because everyone realizes that we have to do something, kind of like Mr. Jackson said, we have to do something to keep our language alive.
And Anna, of course, that's what your organization does, and what it's an umbrella organization. Are there policy measures that need to be taken, or is this just each group taking care of their own language and working hard to revive it?
I think it's a combination of both types of approaches. People are motivated and inspired when they know that there's other groups around the world that are doing the same type of work, because it's very isolating. It can be. Most of the language activists and educators I've worked with, they feel like they're climbing this uphill battle, and it might come down to just a very small number of dedicated individuals in the community, often teachers and some really passionate students who are really carrying the burden for everybody. And people might not respect the work that they're doing. But there's also conferences and events and festivals that really celebrate and promote indigenous language through music and film and arts. So those are ways that people can connect more broadly on a national scale and a global scale. And the problem really is worldwide. We study language extinction from a global scale.
Well, I would say probably diversity of Native, you know, for instance, indigenous peoples worldwide. I think it makes it even harder to revitalize languages because there are just so many languages.
And they are unique. I mean, that's precisely it, right? I mean, it's a unique language. Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Marty Richardson, director of the Halawasapone Historic Legacy Project. Ana Luisa Daño is program director at Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. And Gilliam Jackson is a longtime Cherokee language teacher and adjunct instructor of Cherokee at UNC Asheville. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Bilahook.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, mixed media artist who creates huge works with surprising objects. Stay tuned.